Hello.
Hello there, Miss Lucinda. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Very
Wonderful,
good.
wonderful. I'm glad that we are meeting. I have just a slight adjustment or two to make so I can see everything I need to see.
Okay.
In the meantime, I enjoyed reading about your stellar career in the theater.
Well, somehow I wound up with at the age of 69 with the retirement project of the century here. It's starting a professional theater. It just was one of those things. It just couldn't get away from it.
Well, that means that you're very, very good at what you do
Well, it worked out pretty well. We're
when they won't
still,
let you go.
no, it won't let me go. Not at all. I keep trying to retire, and every time I do, something happens and I have to wind up coming back in again. That's okay. That's life. You know, I'm not ready for the dustbin.
Neither am I, even though,
Yeah.
some days I feel like the dustbin and I work
I,
like a crazy
yeah.
person.
I know exactly what you're saying. This is a great project you're doing. How many people are involved, actually?
We have a list of 21 people, and I have spoken with, I think, six so far. I have two or three more already scheduled. Dr. Fine and Dr. Phillips are going to hopefully come on. Oh, goodness, there's your alarm. They're going to hopefully come on at the end of May, I think.
Okay.
I've looked for a lot of people, and some I have been able to find, and some I have not. I am soon going to send a letter out to everyone I've talked to thus far and ask them if they can ask their friends. We've
Sure.
had a couple people who, were just too upset by remembering their experiences that they decided, not to do it after they thought about it a bit. But I really am hoping to capture the experiences of students wherever they went, whatever they did. And it's amazing the wonderful things that I have come across. I'm thrilled. I really would like to try to urge one couple to write a book because they have letters from
Oh.
their experiences while they were in school. They have a whole pastel of letters, and I'm like, oh, an epistolary novel, please.
You know, I should have done that. I should have gone through my boxes of things. I honestly didn't even think about doing that, but that's a good way to refresh your memory, because I have to say, you know, your questions are fantastic, but you know, some of them I think, oh, what was that person's name? I can't, you know, I just can't get it. You get to my age and things slip away.
Well, I do understand, but things are slipping for me too, and
Well,
I'm 18 months from 60, so
all right.
they're slipping. Please believe it.
Well, I'll tell you, just keep your brain active, and it, you know, nothing will ever depart from you
I
completely.
agree. I agree. The more
Yeah.
active you can be, the better.
Sure.
Well, let's launch right in, and
Okay.
if we
Launch.
could, please tell us your full name and the
Okay.
years you were at Swarthmore.
Basically, my legal name is J. Period Lucinda Kidder. Now, when I was at Swarthmore, actually, when I graduated, my name was Lucinda Kidder Brown, because I was one of those really crazy people who got married halfway through. I actually married a guy that I met doing civil rights work down in Fayette County in Tennessee. We got married. He had been teaching at Germantown Friends School, and he was about 8 years older. In fact, he's just gotten back in touch with me. We divorced years and years ago, but he found me somehow online, and he's been getting back in touch. I think he's just getting bored with old age or something. Who knows?
Wow.
Anyway, let's see. Yes, I was at Swarthmore between 62 and 66. Graduated in June of 66. And my older brother was classes of 60, I'm sorry, 66 was my graduating year. His was 62 from Swarthmore. Mm. I keep thinking my high school year because it's my 60th reunion from there now. So anyway, he went there. And of course, I had said I would never go there. But then I went on a tour and I can't even remember what it was that convinced me to go, but I just did. Actually, I went to a private school up here in New England, and my whole family went there. Actually, my grandfather made it possible for us. While I was there, I was involved with the church, and I actually started a social action committee because, you know, I had one Black student in my class, and you had to really hunt to find anybody who was a person of color in the entire student body. So I thought this was pretty shabby and went to the admissions department and got them going on actually reaching out to some of the locations and trying to find some schools where people had children who could benefit from being here. We had plenty of scholarships, and it's actually the school I went to is one of the less expensive ones, thank goodness, but started to really work on that while I was in high school. In my senior year of high school, became very aware of what was going on in the civil rights movement, because my brother was at Swarthmore at the time, and he and his eventual wife really got involved as well. They were a sort of a spark, and that just sort of led me into coming to Swarthmore in the first place. So
where did you go to high school?
It used to be called Northfield School for Girls, a very much a girls' school, but it's up in Northfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And we had a pretty good record. I mean, it was founded by an evangelist, Dwight L. Moody, who was very much a person devoted to diversity. Actually, he was way ahead of his time. The first graduating class literally had, I think there were four students, one of whom was a Black person, one of whom was Native American. I don't know whether they had an Asian. I doubt that very much. But in other words, he was very much devoted to making sure that there was a diversity. And unfortunately, somewhere along the way, headmasters or headmistresses, whatever, lost that sense of the need for diversity. And now, of course, the school is very diverse, actually. Thank goodness they've gone in the other direction, which is great. But it's interesting, you know, I talk about my theater. We're right in the middle of a run of Joshua Harmon's play, Admissions, mm-hmm. which is about white privilege and white expectations. And it's just been a phenomenal play to do. People, you know, I live in an area that is probably 89-90% white. And but very liberal. We're blue as far as that goes. So people really are interested in these kinds of topics, and we get a good response when we do the kind of plays that I like to do, which are generally involved with social justice issues. And that's sort of something I've carried with me. But
you have answered a question that is a through line among yep. our wonderful interviewees, and we'll talk more about it later, but
all righty.
It's wonderful that you all have not just been historical figures in civil rights, but you carried that work forward into your life. Yeah. Every single one of you has done so yep. in some sort of way. And so I find that really, really a wonderful attribute for the kinds of people that you were then and that you are now, you know.
They shaped us. That whole period shaped us so drastically. I mean that in a good way.
Well, talk more about your shaping.
Well, basically, I think it shaped us that we had to question things. We could not, and certainly Swarthmore in general shapes you to do that. You can't just sit back and say, well, that's because somebody else said so. You have to do your own thinking, and that atmosphere of questioning and not taking for granted authority figures, that sort of thing, but also just the kind of compassion that I found, I did get involved. One of your questions was about getting involved with the Quaker aspect. And I did actually join meeting when I was there and was very, very interested. In fact, my first marriage, the guy that I married halfway through, we had a Quaker wedding. And, but it was that ethic, that approach to doing the doing of civil rights, it appealed to me a great deal because I don't know as I completely would characterize myself as a total pacifist. Yeah, probably pretty darn close to it though. I mean, it's just something that the idea of violence as a way of solving problems is a theme that I've carried through in my educational work as well. Taught a lot of kids and I've done a lot of improvisational theater. And one of the things that I've learned from the kids that I've worked with is that so many of them only can see violence as a solution to a problem or a conflict that exists. And in absolutely forbidding a violent solution, they have to start thinking about some way else.
Another way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's that's been a very valuable tool. And I just think that was very well funded. I can imagine other schools where there might not have been such a consciousness of the way in which you approach civil disobedience and the ideas that go along with the Gandhian approach, for example. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, to me, that was just so key. And I was very, very taken with that at the time, still am.
Do you find... if, as you look back on your experiences, you went to Swarthmore, but not a Quaker and became one. So do you find that the Quaker religion as a foundation for the school really influenced you in what you did and how so?
Well, absolutely. I think the idea of action combined with spiritual conviction. Mm-hmm. Plus the idea of listening to other people, the idea in meeting when somebody stands up, you may not agree with what they're saying. And you also may wish they'd just sit down because they're going on too long. and sometimes, you know, some meetings get to the point where the usual suspects are the ones that speak mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, but that's a hazard, I guess you could say, for that form of worship. But on the other hand, there are some beautifully inspired people who can get to the nugget of an issue or a situation and just to listen to them and to think through, you know, share with them their thought processes. You don't get that in you know, your standard religious practices, generally speaking. You know, you get preached at, and it's very unusual where lay people are so much involved in the actual structuring of the spiritual guidance and spiritual education. So I found that, and yet it's not something that I kept up. I kept going back to it from time to time, but I've moved so many times. That's part of my problem. I don't have deep roots much of anywhere except where I'm living right now, actually in Western Mass. So.
Do you have, can you talk more about any pre-Swarthmore experiences you had growing up that really kind of got you interested in activist work?
Well, not quite sure it would be activist. I mean, my family was a church going family. Every Sunday we were very involved with stuff. So, I mean, he's not United Methodists and, you know, church groups, choirs, you know, the whole thing. We did not socialize. We didn't go do country clubs type stuff mm-hmm. or parties or any of that kind of stuff. We were very much, I mean, church was our social life, basically. So, you know, there were four of us kids and my mom and dad each had responsibilities at the church, you know, helping out with the board and the, you know, I can remember the whole family would come in when they were remodeling the Sunday school rooms or something. And my brother used to get off on really wrecking, you know, pulling down the old walls. He really loved tearing down the church. you know, just the idea that this is a very central part of our lives. And this is how we organized ourselves. Very family-centric and church-centric. So that the kinds of you know, outreach experiences that we would do sometimes. The food pantry wasn't as common back then. That was not as much a thing that was being done. But I know my grandfather also was very involved. He taught at, he was a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And he often would have international students staying over with him during vacation times when they couldn't go home and that sort of thing. So we met people from all kinds of different backgrounds and so on. So I think that exposure to a fairly diverse, I mean, the church itself, I have to say, was not diverse, particularly. There were a few Black families involved, but generally speaking, it was standard. You know, there was an AME church down the road, and that's where the Black folks went. So,
right.
Yep.
I am the daughter of a Baptist minister and the niece of an AME Zion minister when there were no females.
Oh my goodness.
She was a minister, a very powerful woman. And I, like you, grew up in church. There was a period of time that we were in church 6 days a week.
Oh my God.
Everything. Oh. We had clubs. This is a little teeny church. So we had sewing clubs. We had two or three choirs, four or five, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And of course the Wednesday prayer meeting where those folks would stand up and the usual suspects and talk forever. So I absolutely know that experience well. But when I went to college, I defected. Well, I went to Hollins University.
Okay.
I didn't want to go there, just like you didn't want to go to Swarthmore until you just got there and saw the place. Yeah. And it's like, oh, you know, it's enchanting. Yeah. So
it really was. And I think, you know, just having that background made it easy for me to ease into, because I mean, at my school, for example, we had people like William Sloan Coffin come and speak. You know, some of the big movers and shakers in the rights movement were invited to campus. And the school itself, I'd have to say a fair number of them came from very upper class, somewhat upper class, but mostly we were a sort of middle class, but we were very white. And I can remember experiences that classmates had, which I only learned about later from, for example, religion teachers who taught that the Jews were Christ killers. I mean, and that's, you know, that's a horrible kind of thing. And I just learned too. And some of my
LBGT plus.
The whole string. Yeah. Some of my classmates who could not come out at that time. I mean, we're talking there of the late 50s, early 60s.
And
it was frightening for them. And, you know, most of us, at least I would say some of us at least, were exceptionally naive about other choices and other gender choices, anything like that. I mean, you know, God, we didn't know much about sex in general because we were a girl school. But, you know, I think that's the kind of environment that it certainly, by my senior year, even though I had gotten elected to the head of the church cabinet and had to give sermons sometimes and do prayers and that sort of thing, I lost my faith that year. I mean, it was just one of those things. It was like there was too much responsibility to feel like I had a real solid faith, and it's just sort of like slipped away. But I think that's when I could connect it to a social action that made more sense to me. It was no longer an abstraction. It really felt like there was, and certainly the songs. I mean, the songs of the movement. I can't even talk about them hardly without a lump in my throat. Went to the March on Washington, the whole nine yards, and just, I mean, it was just a phenomenal time. Very, very.
I'm sorry to interrupt your last statement, but if you can tell me about how, after you entered campus, you migrated to the activist students and any students you can remember that really influenced how you were thinking.
Well, Nick Eagleson, Tom Hayden was there, of course, and Michael Ferber was in my class, and he was a very close friend. And I don't know, I just naturally, those are some of the folks. Linda Gretzinger was one of the interviews you did, and she was a close friend. And just other friends. And actually, I had requested a Black roommate, you know, when I was there. And my roommate actually was, her name was Elena Campbell. And she actually, this is how naive I was. She actually became pregnant during her sophomore year. She and I roomed together both first and second years. And she had to take time out to have the baby. So I wound up her son's godmother. Oh. Yeah. But she lived up in Brooklyn. And but, you know, and I knew Sarah Lawrence, of course. Now, Sarah was interesting because later, too, I've had conversations with her because she did not get involved in the rights movement at all. She had the feeling, I think, at the time that it was her responsibility to become the very best that she could. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was amazing. She taught me how to play the guitar, and she was so like Odetta. She was just amazing. But, you know, we would spend weekends sometimes up at her folks' house in Spring Valley, and just, but those folks, she quite consciously did not take part in the SDS. And I did join SDS, yes. And then the summer of my, let's see, here's where the brain gets fuzzy. One of our summers, anyway, I'm pretty sure it was right after we got we got married, the fellow that I met down in Fayette County, we got married in 64. Mm-hmm. And then that summer, there was an SDS commune co-op kind of thing down at doing in South Philly. And they were working with some of the migrant workers. But it taught you asked about the other types of movements. It was very sexist in a lot of ways because us women would stay at home and, you know, stay around and, you know, do typing and produce papers and signs and whatever. And the guy and cook dinners and clean, keep the apartment clean where we all hung out. And the guys would go off to work with the, you know, meet up with the migrant workers and help them try to improve their conditions. So it was pretty sexist in that way. I think that was very much a sign of the times that the leadership was generally speaking male and mostly white. Yep, definitely. Certainly the Fourth War contingent there was. So,
well, in the five different civil rights movements going on during this time, which I greatly enjoyed telling students about over the years, every single one of them, except the American Indian movement, and just because it's the American Indian movement where they are not sexist, generally, they've never been. But the other civil rights movements, well, the women's movement wasn't, but the Chicano movement, the civil rights movement of Black people, and pretty much the gay rights movement were signs of the times as far as quote unquote sexism, with the leadership being male and the supporters being female. And, you know, Angela Davis is absolutely perfect in talking about her experiences, you know, busting into the Black Panther movement with, you know, okay, I'm ready to do, and no, I'm not getting coffee. You know, let's.
No, exactly.
She's not the coffee getter, y'all. It's not going to be like that. So
that's right.
Can you tell me a little more about your summer of 64? There was so much going on that, I mean, aside from the honeymoon.
Right.
what other kind of work were you doing that summer?
Mostly we spent the whole summer in that Philly apartment. And as I say, I don't have a whole lot of recollection of it, honestly, because, you know, obviously it was very momentous, but I know I did get involved with some of the anti-war movement as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember, it was Bertrand Russell. Obviously, he was very influential. And there was one of our students, except I think he might have been a Haverford student. I'm not sure. We did some demonstrating. And of course, we did go to some conferences, peace conferences around the country. I remember traveling in a van. We were all stuffed in and we were driving to Toronto. It was not comfortable.
I bet. That's a long drive.
We stopped off at Michael Ferber's mother's house. He lived in Buffalo. Okay. We stopped off at his house and she put us up overnight and gave us her apricot bread for breakfast. I still have the recipe.
Wonderful.
But, you know, that was an international conference and I don't recall what organization organized it, to be very honest. But it was that was shifting over into the anti-war movement, though, the Vietnam protests and that sort of thing. I think probably was quite a bit. It might have been 65 or so. But
I have heard from students that essentially the work you started shifted or was pretty much consumed by the anti-war movement, because for heaven's sakes, you know,
it was
really bad. And after the voting, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Act, the 64 legislation passes, it kind of takes a little bit off of it, but at least it opens the door where you can certainly shift over to something else. So that makes a lot of sense. Did you have friends who also experienced that shift from civil rights to Vietnam?
I'd have to say that the SDS contingent pretty much shifted in that direction. And I can't remember what type of a factory it was, but there was some kind of a factory not too far from Swarthmore where we were demonstrating one time at anti-war, and a contingent of John Birchers showed up. And there was some pretty hot and heavy, I don't want to call them conversations, even confrontations with some of these people. And certainly I never felt ready to confront these people. I had a rather tender upbringing, as you can imagine. And it just, you know, the idea of people whose views were so completely 180 degrees from what I'd grown up with was just incomprehensible to me. I don't think most of us, I think, expected that we were right and we were going to change the world. And you got to listen to us. I mean, it doesn't matter how young we are. But then, you know, just that whole idea. I mean, certainly ever since then, you know, there's been before the Iraq War, the involvement there, that was something that very much beckoned to me. And I mean, just that type of protest. And yet, and actually, when we got into COVID, one of the first things I had scheduled, of course, with my theater, all sorts of things to be doing live. But the first thing that we did when we had to go virtual was a play called Days of Possibilities by a New York playwright who had written it for Zoom. And I invited 20 of my actors and community members and patrons and anybody that wanted to do it. We did a reading of this, and actually it was done on May 4th, I think it is, 1916 or 70. What was the Kent State shooting date?
May 4th, 1970.
Yep. And we did it. It was several theaters around the country read this play, and it was set on the Oberlin campus, as a matter of fact. He had interviewed Oberlin people. I think he went there or something. But he had interviewed Oberlin people and also, you know, students of different opinions. And it was just a marvelous experience. I mean, I didn't worry about casting it. It was just anybody that wanted to take part. And I had more volunteers than I could handle. But that was, from that time, I mean, I've done premieres of plays that address a lot of these types of issues. So it's encouraging local playwrights, that kind of thing.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just say that live performance is just, in my opinion, it's the very best way to engage an audience, to really start thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
Because you embody an issue, and suddenly it's not so remote. It's not on a page, it's up on the stage, and you're listening, you're engaged with these people, and a good playwright with a really good play can just make such a huge difference. I love the talkbacks we have afterward with people, and had some amazing responses from people whose attitudes have shifted because of what they're seeing. So
this is a wonderful thing. In that unfortunate period when I tried to get a PhD, which was the wrong thing to do, my dissertation director was, her area of specialty was drama in the Harlem Renaissance. I know my area of specialty was poetry in the Harlem Renaissance, and I know absolutely nothing about drama. But I learned over time how drama in New York, especially among the Jewish community and the Black community, were profound events that really solidified a lot of people and gave them a sort of protection, a feeling of greater safety or understanding, because they could see themselves from themselves on stage. So
exactly.
Yes. So and in African traditions, there's agitprop theater, which is exactly what you're talking about. Exactly. Pretty much, if you can, really engage with that audience, but still continue your theatric presentation. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So let me ask about one person that seems to be very influential, and that is Carl Whitman. Did you run into Carl Whitman?
Of course, yes. Okay. You know, it's funny, Carl. When I was trying to write some notes, with the things, I could not remember his last name. I just couldn't. But Carl, I didn't know as well, because of course I started getting involved as a freshman. So I was kind of a lowly person. And I did not really have any interpersonal connections with him, except that he was our leader. He ran the meetings and so on. And he would send us out for demonstrations. We did some demonstrating in Chester, of course. And I remember got arrested. We were doing a sit-in at one of the schools down there because they were holding classes in a boiler room. And that was just such a horrendous issue. I also worked at the Chester Community Center there, taught some classes down there, and got to know several of the families who actually came to my first marriage, our Quaker wedding. he was, I don't remember him that well as a person, because I wasn't really involved in the organ. I was a foot soldier, I guess you'd have to say. I was not.
You all call yourselves that so often. I'm
a mover and a shaker at that point. I've since become much more of a mover and shaker, but that was later on in life. I gathered a lot of courage along the way.
I really find myself wondering more frequently, the more I speak with you all, about the issue of, as you've just said, courage, and how you broke out of what had been up to this point a very secure and safe existence. Even if you were doing work for others, it wasn't like you were suddenly going to be shot at, as dear Miss Lippert said, she was shot at while she was in Tennessee. So and it's Tennessee, for heaven's sake. So I understand that.
Yeah. It was scary sometimes. I can remember, the one time we were driving from an evening meeting and getting followed.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Volkswagen, which of course was a total mark of invasive northerners, mm-hmm. a Volkswagen bug. And we were followed. And I have to say, I myself did not encounter, partly because of what my assignments were when I was working with Virgie Hortenstein, in the community. We were building a community center at that point. And one of our jobs too was we would go out and help some folks with improve their houses. I can remember, actually, I think my first husband and I kind of connected while we were putting tar paper on somebody's roof. So, and, you know, just, and we stayed with a family. I stayed with a family. The Jackson family had about four kids, I think. And I got to stay with them. They were sharecroppers and they in the cabin, and it was cold. It must have been one of our winter breaks or something, because I can remember ice on the bucket in the morning and things like that. But I really did get to know them pretty well and connected with them, you know, for several years afterward, and was able to help out with one of the boys going to Jackson State. That's, you know, my assignments, I can remember doing some voter registration work in the church, in one or two of the churches. But I don't quite recall exactly why I wasn't so much of a target. Just that one time that I can recall that happening. Of course, you know, some of the demonstrations up in the north, we went to Cambridge, Maryland, too. And there was some demonstrations down there. So, I mean, maybe I think I'm the sort of person who tends to forget unpleasant things a little bit because I try to keep optimistic. And so that could be just a personal failing on my part. There may have been some things that went on that I was either oblivious to them or, you know, I just tried to park them in that place where you park things that you'd rather not revisit.
And keep going.
Absolutely.
Revisiting might make you not keep going.
Oh, exactly. No, I mean, I've absolutely felt that you just cannot let, you know, things get to you. You just have to keep moving on. So
as our new to soon to be, I pray, Supreme Court Justice says, persevere.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say this to myself every day. Persevere. Keep going. Persevere, you are not dead yet. So keep going.
Absolutely. I mean, I intend to die with my theater hat on, frankly.
And me in front of my computer screen. Yeah. Oh,
there you go. You use the instruments you've got.
For as long as you can.
As long as you possibly can. Yep.
Can you tell me about any of the relationships you built while you were working and doing various community activities? What was it like when first people saw you coming and you said you wanted to help do this? What kinds of reactions did you receive?
I really remember very positive reactions, to be very honest. And that's just, I'm not quite sure why, but I think one of my approaches has always been that I need to listen to people and just not say, well, I know what's good for you. You just got to sit down and listen to me. And I think that's maybe that helped a little to ease my way into friendships and relationships with people. I'm not terrifically dogmatic. And I think that's one of the reasons why I would never have made a good, you know, strident kind of civil rights leader, because I mean, I believe in the action, in the doing of things, not so much sort of beating, how can I put it? The kinds of discussions that would go on in the evening, for example, you asked about that summer, the kinds of discussions where so much on a sort of a higher policy plane. How are we going to do this? Why are we doing it? It was almost very abstract in a way, to the point of, you know, it reminded me of the kinds of arguments that would go on and that resulted in factions splitting off from other organizations. For example, the whole communist movement, you know, the way in which that fractured. And, you know, you had clearly identified and very different types of movements going on. And it felt like that to me, that everybody had to have an opinion. And I really didn't wasn't that strong about opinions. I was more strong about doing the work. I just wanted to, because I really felt that people don't need necessarily huge ideas. They need somebody to be sympathetic to them, to help them where it's needed, that kind of stuff. So I never would have made, I never would have made a Black Panther, I'm afraid. Regardless of the fact I could never have been one anyway.
No, despite what Forrest Gump said, no. Yeah. It would have been a little hard.
Right.
So you mentioned the SDS. Were you also in any student political action club or the Northern Student Movement or anything like that?
Not really. The SDS was, and of course, Swarthmore was pretty consuming. Mm-hmm. And of course, in my case, I had to move off campus once I got married. I was not allowed to be on campus. So my first, for my junior year, I was living in Powelton Village in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. With my husband, and he was teaching up at Germantown Friends, and I was commuting out to the campus. And I actually did get to know Wally and Juanita Nelson there, though, who were very influential in the peace movement. Mm-hmm. And there was, I got to know some of that group of folks there. And it's interesting because they actually wound up right up here in my whole neighborhood, right in Western Mass. And it was kind of neat to see them again after so many years. But yeah, so that really, you know, the commuting made it more difficult for me. I also, you know, just had to try to keep my books up. I think it, one of the questions I noticed was, did it affect your grades and things? Probably. I'm quite sure that I could have done a much better job had I not been quite distracted, to be honest, by wanting to be involved in these things. And I also sang with the chorus, and I did swimming and stuff like that. So there were other things that engaged me. And by my senior year, of course, I was just trying to get through it and get out. And after that, I actually went to teach in India. So at a Gandhian, I taught English and psychology at a Gandhian basic training college there in the outskirts of Bangalore. And that was another experience and a half. So
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
No doubt.
But yeah, so I think probably that was it, you know, having been married and having to live off campus was, it sort of dampened my ability even to be able to get everything done that I wanted to do.
Did you run into or engage with NAACP people or SNCC people?
Not really. I don't remember them. I'm sure they probably were, you know, came to campus or whatever, but I honestly don't remember that they were. I'm sure they probably were quite a few folks around that were engaged, but I never did. I don't recall it anyway. Let's put it that way. My 77-year-old brain doesn't always.
It's okay. stuff. Did you meet? I think she might have been. Did you meet Gloria Richardson or Judy Richardson or were friends with Penny Patch and engage with them at all?
Well, Penny Patch, Gloria Richardson, the name is so familiar.
She was a great trainer for many of you all when it came to nonviolent action when you were protesting.
I'm sure that's probably the case. I just, you know, the name doesn't, it rings a bell, but it's not necessarily in that context. I just can't place it right now. But Judy
was the student there.
Judy was a student. Yeah. I think she introduced me to peyote, as a matter of fact.
Oh, my goodness.
I may have the wrong Judy, so don't go. yeah, there was one student came back from break, you know, with several buds.
Oh, hey, you know.
It was pretty nasty stuff, frankly, in its pure form.
I hear it will do some nasty things to you too. I've only heard. I ran from those things.
Honestly, I mean, that was the time, and that's interesting to me because, to be honest, that's that's the recollections that people seem to have of later years, you know, going into the later 60s. I mean, I was out in 66, and I was in India at the time, of course, when, you know, we had the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out the year I got there. And you know, people were traveling overland in buses from to go to the ashrams and study with the gurus and so on. And it was very interesting process. But that whole aspect to what happened with the movement, in a sense that it became farther and farther, to my way of thinking, removed from action and it more into this sort of very, just ineffective and sort of a lack of understanding of the bigger picture in a way. And I don't know whether that could be attributable to drug use or, you know, it was certainly coming on the scene at that time in a very heavy way, not as heavy as it, you know, not the opioids and things like we have now, which, I mean, thank God we didn't have it at the time, but because I think to a certain extent, except for stuff like LSD, which was obviously pretty, took some people in places they didn't really want to go. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it too, when I came back from India, I went into a graduate school in Boston and roomed with one of my fellow SDS people and Daniel Pope. Yes, he was one of our roommates, and I cannot remember her name. Honestly, this is, and of course, Sally, Kathy Wilkinson was in my class. And actually I had known her sister at my school. Her sister had gone to my school and was in my class at school. But so I did have some contacts later on, but I moved so often and I've had so many different jobs that kind of lost touch with most of them.
Did you go to the 50-year reunion they had?
I did. Yes. And Kathy was speaking there actually about her experience of having to go to, and as a matter of fact, she was present at the SC at the Weatherman apartment there where they blew up a townhouse.
Oh!
And she barely got out with her skin. And and I had actually visited that townhouse with her sister, you know, a few years before that, before I was at Swarthmore when I was in high school still. Just, that was pretty exciting stuff. But, you know, I mean, she wound up coming back and having to serve prison term for her work with the Weathermen. But that was a development that I really could not support. I just felt that, it was very hard for me to say that terror is any kind of a way out of anything, and fear, anything based on fear, cannot last. It's no pillar for any type of civil or humane society. It just isn't. And so I really have had some difficulty with trying to come to terms with people's attitudes. Well, and of course, with the polarization now, it's just become insane. And
absolutely. You know, we're to the ending kind of questions now, like, you know, what happened to your parents? But at this stage, with most people, we have gotten to the point where you just went to, which is your contemplation of what on earth, you know, it must be like to be right here today in this insanity we have going on, when you basically opened the door for us to do so much better and we just didn't go through the door. How do you feel about that? I know,
well,
I can say I was a kid sat in front of the TV because I'm the TV generation and my parents were but I watched every single bit of this. I watched the whole Vietnam War. I watched every protest. I watched the Edmund Pettus Bridge and our dear John Lewis beat up. I every bit of it. One of my best friends is in the King family of the little girl who was blown up in the 16th Street Baptist Church. I saw it all. I remember when, what's his name? Stokely Carmichael came out with Black Power. I mean, just the whole thing. And
yeah,
it's in my mind like yesterday. And I'm wondering, why are we right here? Did you all not see anything? What happened? What do you think happened?
Well, I think, right now I am very involved. I founded this theater. It's a professional theater. And, you know, one of the things that it took coming into the whole Black Lives Matter to really get to the point where now we have a DEI consultant. We have a much more diverse board. I had to wade through getting rid of, I that's a terrible term, but I had a fairly elderly board. Of white people whose idea of theater was not, it wasn't coming up to mine, and I was getting squashed. And the things I wanted to do, I spent quite a bit of time. Actually, I did a festival of plays by women from Islamic culture in New York. And man, that was a game changer for me. But the idea of doing plays that will bring people into these worlds, it just wasn't flying with my old boards. And I had a terrible time, you know, just muscling those guys out eventually. And now I've got a very good diverse board, and I get money for diversity training, and we select plays based on the ability to have roles for any kind of person that's good for the role, and you know, that bring up issues that aren't comfortable. I mean, this one, admissions, is very uncomfortable for a lot of people, because it just goes, it sort of puts down the idea of, well, why shouldn't we celebrate when a really highly qualified white student gets accepted, whereas when a highly qualified Black student gets accepted, everybody goes bananas, kind of thing. You know, it's kind of the shifting perspectives, and the play itself essentially puts the question of quotas and of you know, the admissions policies of institutions and so on. And it brings it all up, and it just lays it right out there. And that's the kind of theater that I feel has really, it's going to, I don't know if it's going to make a difference. It's my way of trying to do something that will hopefully make a difference. And that's where I'm at right now. That's where I can feel I can do the most thing. I mean, I'm not really capable of doing the big demonstrations kind of things. And I don't know as I have the courage anymore to get out there in a big crowd, because I find it a little scary. But
I can't do it. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, wow.
We demonstrate all the time about everything. And I was leaving class one night and went down North Side and got stopped straight at MLK Boulevard while watching I think it was Trayvon Martin. They were protesting in police brutality at that time. Mm-hmm. And that march was at least a 3-lane road wide. Wow. And it went on for 40 minutes.
Oh my God.
In the dark. So I do understand this, but
yeah,
I couldn't do it now. I just, you know, physically could not do that.
Yeah,
I would like to, but I couldn't because my legs wouldn't carry me. So,
well, that's it. Yeah, I've just been through a bout of cancer, so I'm feeling pretty good. I came out on the other end though, so I'm good.
I'm very glad to hear that. Very glad.
Well, I have to think that, you know, just, it wasn't my time.
There you go. It
wasn't my time. I had to come back and keep this theater going, and so I can hand it over to somebody else in the its best possible form. So
just to back up a moment.
Sure.
What did your parents say? You got arrested.
My parents, I mean, they were the most long-suffering folks. I mean, you know, my brothers, actually, both of my brothers went on, well, one of them, it was Crossroads Africa. He went to Ghana for a summer, my older brother. And then my next brother, he went to Cote d'Ivoire for a summer. And I don't recall exactly the projects. That was through the same, they went to the boys' school that was sort of the partner of my girls' school. Mm-hmm. And they had, so they got to spend the summer over there, and they both got involved in a lot of stuff. My older brother went to Swarthmore, and he and his the woman who would become his wife, who was Alice Hansaker, they also worked in Chester and did a lot of good stuff like that. But my parents, I wanted to get married. I was 19 years old. What was I thinking? My dad got me this great summer job for my freshman year, but I took off and went down with Virgie on one of the 2-week long trips down to Fayette County. And they said, well, okay. I mean, they just knew we were going to do it anyway. They'd always encouraged us to become involved in things. And I think they certainly were. It's interesting too, because they were Eisenhower Republicans from the, you know, at the beginning. They wound up exceptionally liberal toward the end. But it's just, I think we influenced them in a very good way, because I think it was definitely an outgrowth of the way they taught us to look at the world. They certainly, they welcomed anybody and everybody. We would take cross-country trips so that we could see how the rest of the country lived. And, you know, we were not a stuck in the mud sort of family. We were out there learning, and it was a good background. But then that, you know, they had to put up with my finding out about my getting arrested in Chester. I can't even remember whether they saw it on the news or something like that. You know, there's a whole bunch of us that spent the night in jail. So anyway, they were good with it, and they understood that we really needed to do this. So,
and you know, given the upbringing that you had and what your brothers were doing, I'm not at all really surprised that they were as patient and supportive as they were. And you know, back in that time, women were supposed to get married, so they couldn't be. But so mad that you ran off and got married, you know, that's kind of what you're supposed to do. But
this was a guy who was doing civil rights work in the South. He wasn't your average. He certainly wasn't a banker or anything like that.
True.
But anyway, no, they trusted us, which is a good thing, and I think that's contributed to my view of the world as well, that I trust in the goodness of human beings eventually, if they can somehow be brought to a place where they can understand what it's like to walk in somebody else's shoes. Mm-hmm. So that's why I do theater.
Can you tell us a little more about your husband's work in the South during this period?
Well, he was down there with Virgie's group. Mm-hmm. He was sort of a supervisor. I mean, he was an older guy. He was 8 years older than any of us. And he, as I said, he was at Germantown Friends, and he would help kind of supervise some of us, the gangs of us that came down. I think we spent like 2 weeks at a time. I can't really remember exactly what the space of time was that we were down there. But, and then we would do vacation projects too. You know, we'd spring break, go down there on the spring break or something. But he was, as I say, he was actually brought up a Quaker himself. Mm-hmm. So that was in his background. And he was just, you know, very compelling. Of course, I was 19. What did I know? Met him when I was 18. And by 19, he wanted to get married because, of course, he was so quite a bit older. But didn't last as well as it might have. We separated while we were in India. And my second husband was an artist, musician, actually. So very different ways. But
different kind of activism.
Very different.
Yeah. Reaching a different heartstring, you might say.
Yeah, I guess so.
So right. You have actually been the quiet outside agitator. you may not have thought you were doing anything, but you were quietly doing quite a bit. Were you ever called that?
No, I don't recall anybody ever telling me that. Although I've had to say that when I would propose doing a Middle Eastern play, for example, to my board, as I described it, the idea of doing something that, I mean, Anatomy of a Terrorist, you know, I just thought it was a great play, but somehow my board didn't think it would sell. And they may have been right. But I don't think I ever remember being called that. Although the John Birchers might have called me that. I'm sure that's a possibility when we were doing that one demonstration I mentioned. But I was more a background kind of person in that sense. So
I just every time you all say that, I have to laugh. I'm sorry, because you're also very modest in you know, speaking of the weight of your collective action, you may not have wanted to be in the front, but you know, you were not little modest foot soldiers either. I know you say that a lot, but.
Well, somebody's got to be doing the nuts and bolts and keeping things together. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like to do. I like to help people also make connections. That was one of the things that I was really passionate about, is getting to know lots of different people and just connecting people that I thought would be, you know, good matches for not in a marriage type of way, but I mean in the sense of common interests, common goals, this kind of thing, and trying to set up collaborations and bringing arts organizations together so that we could help each other out, that sort of thing. I mean, I think the idea of working together as opposed to, you know, let's form a new organization because there's not one out there that I like, so I'm going to do it myself. But that tends to lead to a very egocentric. I feel like a lot of times it's based on somebody's ego rather than on what you can be doing. So that a lot of my work has been with other theaters and other, you know, playwrights groups, just in general, trying to pull together the kinds of talent that we have and just do, because there's such power with multiple groups.
I'm sure it was a harrowing experience the last 2 years of COVID and no Broadway, no go out of the house, no do anything. And I love to hear that you did a Zoom play. That's just
awesome. We did a lot more, actually. We the entire time, you know, during the worst part of COVID for a year and a half, I made a film about an Auschwitz survivor that was an original work. And we actually produced a play that was written by an NYU professor that was meant for Zoom. And it was about, it was sort of a Buddhist Zen concept of when you die, you go to not purgatory, but the bardo, which is a Zen concept for a sort of a waiting room for when you go off to your next life. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to me. And we made films out of, since we couldn't do these plays live, we filmed them. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had to be very careful. Most of them had to get filmed outdoors, but we had a very active slate of things. The problem was, of course, the money aspect wasn't there. It was very hard to keep the revenue flowing, but we kept going and we had some really exciting things happen during the whole time. So it went by as faster perhaps for me than it did for some other folks.
Well, I would like to thank you for your comments today and your discussion and sharing your experiences. I really appreciate it. I really do.
Well, it's been fun to talk about.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
I've had to dig deeper in that section of my life than I've had to, you know, as I said, I've moved a lot and some aspects, some periods of my life are a blank, pretty much, you know, when the kids were little and I had three little kids under six, you know, all at the same time. So times and my husband was working off in Boston. So, you know, there have been some times that you do kind of suppress, but this was a time that I think it cemented for me a sense of the power, first of all, of Black culture. I mean, I gained a huge appreciation for what that meant, just by being involved and as a integral part of what America is about, or what this country is about. And I think maybe having lived in India for 2 years, where I was definitely not a majority figure. You know, I was taller, actually, and I'm only 5'3" and I'm obviously not the same shade as everybody else there. But that living in that kind of situation, I think I wish more people could do that, could have the experience of just being in a different culture. And mm-hmm. I mean, I find the jingoism that infects so much of America. It's so much because people do not have experiences outside. And it makes me even more scared when I look at what the school systems are doing or not doing in terms of exposing children to other cultures and other, you know, and really, really, I mean, don't get me off on that. That's another whole conversation.
It is. And I wonder what do these crazy people think that they're actually going to do? I mean, are we having Fahrenheit 451 here? I mean, you know,
exactly.
As a person.
Toni Morrison? I mean, my God.
Are you serious? A Nobel Prize, people. And you want to ban her books because she's Black. Mm-hmm. And she talked about the horrors of our early
right.
American history.
It mentioned the word slavery, maybe. Whoa.
Now, that is my favorite book. It's terrible.
I love it. I actually, when I was working at a college up here running a lecture series, I actually had Toni Morrison come. It was right when she was getting the Pulitzer Prize.
Ooh.
And I have a signed copy of Beloved. That's the gem of my
yes life. Indeed. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we had Maya Angelou here too. So I mean it was stunning, just stunning, you know, just fabulous.
Wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, I'm on going to say good night. And it was a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. And I thank you so much. I'm going to send you a note about what's going to happen now.
Okay.
And ask if you have any other friends who would like to speak to us. Please, please tell them to send me an email. We would really love to have their perspective and any artifacts. And
you know what I have? I have a leather shoulder bag kind of thing, a suede leather shoulder bag made by the Fayette County. And right now it's not in great shape, but I would love to have that be preserved. How do I get it to you?
Well, what I'll do is I will send the archivist in Swarthmore Library, Mr. David Overmayer, and send him, as I have with other people who have given us artifacts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I too am an archivist. I'm just a contract one being sorely abused at the moment. But anyway, I do know how hard it is to ingest artifacts. You know, you have to, you know, you've got a plan. So
yeah,
I send him all that information, and then the library staff will work with you to.
Yeah, I could send him a photo,
right?
And you know, it was something I used for a long, long time afterward, but I think I loaned it out as a prop for a play and somebody was a little rough on it because the leather was starting to get a little old. But yeah, it was some kind of like a co-op, maybe an artisan's co-op down in Fayette County, but it's stamped on the bottom.
That would be that. Awesome.
Yeah. And I would love it to have a good home. Really, really would. That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you. And okay. I will send you a note shortly and I will bid you a good night.
Good night. And good luck with all the other folks too.
Thank you so much. Take care of yourself.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.